We have two of these good friends with us this morning. I don't want to take too many liberties with the Reverend Robinson's humility, but I think of the number of letters that came into GSO from those people who know him best, urging that we bring him to this stage this morning. He is pastor of the First Christian Church in Billings, Montana. He's previously pastor of the First Christian Churches at La Grande, Oregon, and Turner, Oregon. He has been a part of the fellowship, not quite so much in the limelight as I have, but deeply loved by those who know him best. And it is my privilege and pleasure to bring to you this morning the Reverend Gene Robinson.
My name is Gene. Hi. My name is not Still Gene, I'll tell you that. I have never been accused of being still in all my life. I was born talking and have been at it ever since. I hope I may do better than a friend of mine described once after a convention speech in which he got up and said, "I like to hear Gene Robinson because he can always get up and give a speech whether he's got anything to say or not." There have been so many questions asked in the past few months since this invitation came that I feel really obligated to try to answer some of them. My friends in AA have said to me, "Why have you been chosen to give this speech?" And I've wondered about it myself. Believe me, I have. I think probably the only explanation is what I gave to our local groups when I told them of the fellow who was elected a deacon in his church, and one of his friends said, "How did you ever get to be a deacon? You're the worst lying, stealing, chasing, carousing man in the whole town. How did you get to be a deacon?" And he said, "Well, I'll admit all of that, but the truth is that the disreputable element in this church just rose up and demanded that they be represented on the board." I wouldn't want to say anything about those wonderful people who wrote those letters, but believe me, I'm here representing somebody this morning. The other part of the explanation I try to give to the members of my family and to my friends outside and to the members of my church, sometimes I try to describe it as I did to a New Year's party in Billings a couple of years ago when I said to them, "I've often wondered what's going to happen to my reputation when my congregation finds out that I spent New Year's Eve with 40 alcoholics. But if you think that's rough, just wait till your friends find out that you spent New Year's Eve with a preacher." I couldn't possibly tell you the story of God as I understand him without making some very personal references, and I hope you'll forgive me for these. But you and I have discovered a long time ago that you don't learn AA out of a book. You learn it down where people live. And where we are, this is where this thing happens, and this is where God reaches us. And so at the risk of being entirely too personal with it, let me tell you something of the story. I was raised in a wide-open town in southern Oregon, a place called Klamath Falls. And at Klamath Falls, Oregon, in the days when I was a young fellow, there were just two kinds of people, really, in our community, the rowdies and the blue noses. You had to make your choice which kind you were going to be, and I didn't want to be one of the rowdies, and so I became a blue nose. Thank God, in years later, I learned that there is another way of life, and I have come to it. But in the process of those years as a blue nose, living in a teetotaling family, I remember that we took into our home one year a man who was a veteran of the First World War. He lived on a pension, a disability pension, and everything went along real fine with Frank until that pension came every month. And then we had trouble keeping him and the pension together, and if they both If they both got to town at the same time, you could be sure that one or the other, and sometimes both, didn't come home. Well, I remember one night that my folks had searched the local bars until they found Frank, and they brought him back home again. I was about 13 years of age, as I remember it. I had already decided that I wanted to be a minister, but I was a long ways from understanding what being a minister really involved. And I remember that Frank got me collared up against the wall in the living room. The rest of the family had listened long enough, and they weren't listening anymore. But I was still listening, and I remember that he put his arm on the wall. I think the wall was moving, I'm not sure. But he put his arm on the wall, and he leaned right over me to talk to me. From that day to this, I have recognized the smell of secondhand alcohol without any trouble at all. And I recall that Frank said to me, "Gene, you want to be a preacher?" And I said, "Yes, I do." And he said, "You want to do something to help people, don't you?" And I said, "Yes, Frank, I do." And he said, "Well, then, for God's sake, do something to help me quit my drinking, will you?" I don't know whether Frank is still alive or dead. I've lost track of him in more than 30 years since that time. But I know that the words that Frank spoke and the look that he gave me that day have never gone away from me, and I'll never escape them as long as I live. It was about that same year that there came to our community an evangelist. Those were the days of the Depression. That fellow preached every night for 4 weeks. Believe me, that was preaching, and that was listening. And I listened to a lot of it. And when the meeting was all over, our minister went to the Ministerial Association and then came back and told our congregation that he'd reported to them. When they asked him how many new members came into your church during that 4 weeks, he said there were 53 and one drunk. I remember the night that one drunk came. I will vouch for the minister's statement that he was drunk when he came. But somehow the thing that our pastor said, as wonderful a man as he was, just never went down straight with me. It lodged in my throat. Because even as a boy, I said to myself, no, there were 54 people. That man was drunk, he had done many things wrong, and many things wrong had been done to him. But he was still the child of God, created in the image and the likeness of God, and I pray that God will never help me to forget it. I started to preach. I faced many problems, but they were trivial and insignificant compared to some that came later. In 1946, I went to become pastor at La Grande, Oregon. There came into our services on a Sunday evening the following year a man whose wife conned him into going to church, if the truth is known. And I recall that he went out in a real huff because he was positive she'd briefed me and filled me in on his life. He said nobody could come that close to the way I live if somebody hadn't told his preacher ahead of time. Well, he kept on coming. He kept coming long enough that this fellow is here in our convention today. And I've hunted all over this convention this morning for Les M. from La Grande, Oregon. I lost him after breakfast, and I haven't been able to find him. I wanted him right down here in these front rows while I speak, but maybe it'll be easier for me to say it if I can't see Les. But if ever there was a man in the world who was a non-alcoholic with a sponsor, I'm it. And Les is my sponsor. And I recall one day that I sat in my office in La Grande and the telephone rang. And here was a fellow who was having trouble with his words and with his thoughts and who was very, very drunk. And we had a Salvation Army captain in our town who delighted in putting on an act of one sort and another. And I said, aha, Captain Scriven, that's who I've got. And after 3 or 4 things in which I strung him along a little bit, it began to dawn on me that I didn't have Captain Scriven at all. I had a man who was looking for help. I said, I'll come to you or you can come to me, whichever is best. And he said, if you'll stay there, I'll be there in 5 minutes. He was there in far less than 5 minutes. And Les came in and talked to me about the problem that he faced and about the breakup that had come in his first home and about the breakup that was almost to come in his second home because of his drinking. He talked to me about a lot of things, and then I remember that Les said to me, can you help me? For God's sake, help me. I didn't know much about it. I knew something of the evils of drink. I knew something of the power of God. But I learned that morning that I hadn't learned very much about either one. And I began to talk to Les, and I said, Les, I know that I can't help you. That much I know. I know that you can't do this thing yourself. That much I know. I know that only the power of God can help you. And I'll never forget how he looked across that desk at me and he said, Gene, I'll buy that, but how can the power of God get through to a drunk like me? And I couldn't answer his question. But before God that morning, I made a vow that someday I'd be able to answer that question. And I recall that a doctor in our community referred Les to a doctor in Portland, and he went down there for 2 weeks. The doctor treated him in the daytime and took him to AA meetings at night. He kept him busy, you can be sure. And at the end of 2 weeks, Les came back to me and he said, Gene, I found it. And I think that you found it too. And he showed me some literature. There wasn't much then compared to what there is now. But he showed me what he had. He told me of the wonderful program. He told me of a group that existed in Pendleton, Oregon, 56 miles away. But for 2 years, this man of God who came to me as the angel of God that day, he thought he was looking to me for help. And I knew that I found my help through him that day. This man went to meetings over the hill to Pendleton, but he had no one else in the town of LeGrand. And for 2 years, he was a loner in the community. And he and I talked it out together. And Les delights in telling people that I was his sponsor and I was his teacher. He just puts it very well when he says, I didn't know anything about the program and Gene didn't know anything about the program, so we taught each other. And that's just exactly the way it happened. And when Les gets to the place of telling me, when Les gets to the place of telling in front of me that I was his teacher, it reminds me of a very wonderful woman in our city of Billings who's taught for a number of years in specialized education, and she teaches retarded children. And one day she and her husband were coming out of a drugstore in Billings just as one of her pupils and his mother came through the door, and in a clear voice that only a child can speak, she heard him say, Mama, look, there comes my retarded teacher. And for 17 years after Les and I have come on this program together, I have tried to be his retarded teacher. And he has been the angel of God to me. And I want to tell you the rest of the story, and that is that Les was later a deacon in the church of which I was pastor and was chairman of our board of deacons, and he was so good at it that we always called him the sneaking deacon. Now, what I'm trying to say to you has a lot to do with my understanding of God, because you see, I started out as a servant of God, and I'd taken my ordination vows some 8 or 9 years before. But I discovered that God was out looking for me a long time before I ever started out looking for him. I thought I had found him. But he had a quality, he had something to offer to me, he had a great thing in my ministry that could only be offered through the medium of AA, and I praise God for the day that Les came through my door and said, let's find this thing together. And I believe that this is still true, that if God looked for me, God looks for you. And he doesn't stand around and wait for somebody to set out and make the search for God long before we ever even heard of him. God was looking for us. And when he finds us, this is the miracle of all, that God likes us. And I use that term deliberately. I love the thing that Dr. Norris read to us this morning about the love of God. He who loves his brother can see God. Yes, this I believe. This I have found and learned. But I use that term sometimes rather hesitantly because so many times it's been abused. A member of my congregation came in one day and he said, do you still say that I have to love everybody? And I said, you bet I do. And he said, well, does that mean I have to like the so-and-sos too? Well, a lot of us are asking that question, and sometimes we're not asking, does God love me? Oh, yes, I know this. But I want to know, does God like me? I don't know sometimes how God can even understand me, or how God can even stand me at all. Believe in myself, and at the time that I cannot stand myself, in the time that I cannot stand up and say, here I am, a child of God, even in that moment, I know that God likes me. And this to me is the greatest miracle of all. Not that he helps me, but that he likes me while he's helping me. And I don't believe that anybody will ever come to a better understanding of God than this. This is the essence of it all. But now, here again, I want to qualify for a moment what I'm saying. Because you see, a lot of people have interpreted this thing wrong. They've looked on AA and the love of God as some kind of a soft blanket, as some kind of a pillow on which people are carried. You ask the average man along the street what he knows about AA, and he knows something about it. But what he knows so often is that he thinks he knows that AA is a real soft-hearted guy who sits by the telephone waiting for it to ring so he can come and hold somebody's hand while he cries and feels sorry for himself. And to the average person, this is what AA does. And I said to the members of my congregation last Sunday morning, read the 12 steps, which I have printed on the back page of the bulletin for today. And you begin to see that what we're talking about here is a total program, and there's nothing easy about it at all. It's a tough thing to face up to this and to get on this program. When you talk about admitting the exact nature of your wrongs to God and to another person and to yourself, there's nothing really easy about this, is there? A lot of us have spent a lot of years trying to con God. We've been trying through the years to pull things over on Him, and we've suddenly begun to discover that it cannot be done. There are two things that you cannot con. One of them is the wife of an alcoholic, and the other one is God, who likes and loves alcoholics. And I never heard it put better than I did in one time a story of a fellow whose wife kept at him. She knew something was wrong. She didn't quite know what. And she kept at him, go to the doctor, go to the doctor. Well, he knew better than to go. But he knew he didn't dare to stay home. And finally he went. And the doctor checked him over. And I'll refer to Dr. Jack here in a moment, see? And the doctor checked him over and he said, well, boy, I can tell you one thing. You've got to quit drinking. You're drinking entirely too much. The fellow started home, but he knew he didn't dare to take home a story like that. And so he walked slowly along the street, trying to find what he could explain to his wife. And as he went along, he passed a music store. And in that music store, he read in the display the word syncopation. And he said, that's it. She won't know what that means. So he went home, and when she asked him what was wrong, he said, well, the doctor says I have a very bad case of syncopation. She said, what in the world is that? And he said, well, I don't know, but you know how these doctors are. They always have a big word for it. And she said, well, I think we'd better check on that. That sounds bad. So she got down the dictionary and looked in it, and it says that syncopation is an irregular movement from bar to bar. And I learned a long time ago that when you deal with God, you deal with one who is just that way, and you can't con him at all. But isn't it a wonderful thing that he likes us well enough to lay on the whip once in a while? He likes us well enough to say, there are some things you cannot do. There are limits. Every time there's love. There is no such thing as love without limits. Think, if you will, of the illustration of marriage. Someone has said that marriage is a situation in which a person puts on a little band of gold around his finger, and that band of gold cuts off his circulation. Well, there are limits to love. There are limits to love every time, and God is not soft with us. He has the nerve to do what needs to be done. But somehow it comes through to us loud and clear every time that God likes us very much. Another thing I've learned in understanding God in these 17 years, particularly since I have been working so closely with AA, is that God listens to me. And this is a peculiar sort of thing because, you see, I deal with a lot of people who are convinced, at first at least, that nobody ever listens to them except an occasional bartender and a few of his patrons. And the unfortunate thing is that they're just about right. A lot of the people in churches, a lot of the nice people who go to church this Sunday morning are people who are not ready to listen when a man says, here's my soul and I want to share it with you. And I thank God that he is not one of the nice people, but he's the sort that simply stops and listens when I have something to say. There are a great many people who say, I wish that I had the ability to stand up in public and talk. My friends, the greater gift of God by far is to sit quietly with one man and listen. And this is exactly the thing that God does, and this is where I find him, in the moments that I, too, learn to listen. Now, a lot of us get the idea that you shouldn't clutter up God with the things that, you know, are real problems. I have members in my congregation who treat me this way. They say, we don't like to call you and tell you all of our problems and burden you with all these things. They like to talk to me about little things and criticize each other and be trivial sometimes, but they certainly don't want to trouble me with big things. And whenever I hear this or I hear somebody say, I don't want to pray and burden God with all this, I'll do it myself. I can do it myself, you know. It reminds me of a friend of mine who lived neighbor to me while I was in high school. She lived in a house. She was a woman 70 years old and lived in a house up on a side hill. And 365 nights a year, she slept in a screen porch in a very cold climate. She was one of the sturdy people of the world, you can be sure. And she was the chairman of the committee in charge of everything in our neighborhood. She was one of these. Well, one night, she heard thieves in her chicken house that was down across the road from the house. She always slept with a shotgun right by her bed, and she slipped out of bed, pushed open the screen door, and blazed away with this shotgun. By the time she had emptied the second barrel, her son came jumping right through from his bedroom window out onto the porch where his mother was. And when she told him what it was, he said, "Why, Mother, why didn't you call me?" She said, "Oh, son, I knew that you'd had a real rough day and that you were tired, and I just didn't want to bother you at all." And there are a lot of us who don't want to bother God with our prayers. But I have discovered the truth of that thing that I use on my calling cards that says, "Pray daily." God is easier to talk to than most people. This is mighty true. And then I've discovered another thing, and that is that God lifts me. And here again, I use the term advisedly because, you see, we've been dealing for a long time in a situation where we say, "Well, I get a lift out of this drink." There are a lot of us who haven't stopped to think what alcohol really is and what it does. It's amazing how many people have never really thought it through. But when we come on the program many times, we want that same kind of lift, the sort of thing that blots out, the sort of thing that gives us a temporary relief. And God is not interested in this kind of temporary relief at all. He wants to do a thoroughgoing job on us, and he's willing to do that job. But he doesn't do it from a distance. He is never hard to reach. Because, you see, the hand of God is always close, and it reaches right down to us. And when that hand of God reaches out, it often is dirty because it has gotten into somebody else's problems too. But he's willing to offer to us the hand of help. And when he does, he goes the whole way. He goes in the process. The process that begins by saying that we're going to admit that we need the help of God. And the process that goes right on to say that we determine to turn our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. And I'd like to put the emphasis on the first part rather than the last, because I am thoroughly convinced that nobody will ever come to really understand God until he learns to turn his life over to the will and the care of God, however he may understand him. One friend of mine said, "I said when I came on this program, how can I do that? I don't understand God at all." And a friend of mine said, "Well, then turn your life over to God as you misunderstand him." This is exactly the thing that needs to be done. And this is the place where it begins. When I was living in LeGrand, I walked down the hall of St. Joseph Hospital one night. One of the grandest Christian women that I've ever known is a spunky little Irish nun by the name of Sister Frances. I'd love to see her now. I heard last she was in Tacoma, Washington. And I recall that as I went past the door of the chart room, she said, "Gene, come here a minute. I need to talk to you." I walked into that chart room and she said, "There's a woman here right in the next room and I don't want her to hear me. But she's been having a terrible time all day and a lot of us have tried to get through to her and we're not getting through. I know you've called on her a time or two. Go in and see what you can do, will you?" I made my other calls, and then I came back to this room last, expecting to spend considerable time. This woman said to me, "I've got to get out of here. I'm having terrible trouble. I need to go home." And I said to her, "What's the big rush about going home from the hospital all of a sudden?" She said, "Well, you know I have a ranch up in Wallowa County, and I have fences that need to be repaired and cattle that need shots and hay that isn't in and a barn that needs a roof fixed," and she made a list that just made me tired clear through as I listened to it. And finally, I said to her, "Do you mean to tell me you've been down here in this hospital for 2 weeks and there's nobody at home to take care of your ranch at all?" She said, oh, I've got two daughters and two son-in-laws up there, but you know how these young people are. They can't take care of things, and they need me. Well, I said to her what a minister of God is expected to say. I said, you know, there are times that we can't run everything ourselves. There are times that we need to just relax and let go of these things, let go and let God, you see, to let go of these things and put all of our problems in the hand of God and let Him run our lives. Just like that, she said, oh, I couldn't do that. Think what a mess everything would get into. I laughed at first and then I was shocked. I didn't know which was the proper emotion under the circumstances, but I went on out in a minute. I went back down the hall and I found Sister Frances and I said, now, here, you come in the chart room with me this time, and this time I shut the door. And I said to her, I want to tell you what that woman said to me. I told her, and we both stood up against the walls and laughed. And then all of a sudden we both turned very serious, and Sister Frances looked right straight at me, and she said, Jean, about the only difference between her and us is that she's a lot more honest than you and I are. And I know she was telling me the truth. Straight from God. But I know that this whole process and this whole 12 steps and this whole rebuilding of a life that's far more than the mention of alcohol and alcoholism, this is a way of life. This is a new character that is built. And this done by the power of God is the process. But thank God it is also a partnership. For God lifts me, not only through the program to which I come, but through the people whom I find. I've reveled in the glories of the fellowship of these days. And I have found that AAs are AAs the world around. And wherever you run across them, somehow there's a tie that binds, and it's the tie that begins in failure and ends in the power of God. And I think that I want to pay my tribute this morning to everyone who in any way does his stint in 12-step work. But even more, I want to pay my tribute to the Al-Anon members, to the friends of AA, who somewhere are willing to not just sit in the background, but to be down there where people are. For wherever a man... wherever I've found a man who has been lifted to the power of God, I know that he's laid hold on that power through some human hand that's stretched out to him. I know a lot of people who say, I want to die with my boots on. Maybe they say that more in Montana than they do over here in Ontario. I have a wonderful pair of Wellington boots, but I don't want to die with them on. Believe me, I want to live with those. But I have discovered that as I reach out my hand for my own help and put my hand into the hand of God, He immediately tells me to reach out my hand on the other side and see if I can't find someone else who's reaching out a hand to Him too. I found it first through a human hand reaching to me. I hope by the grace of God be able to pass it on like the school kids used to do in that simple little game. And so I pray that God will give me the grace to reach to the hand of God on one side and on the other, to reach out to any man anywhere who seriously wants the help of God. And this is the only way that there is that I know to really live. But believe me, brother, it's living. Clear to the core and clear to the very heights. One of the greatest philosophers of earth is a man who said that this whole thing is built about the profound humiliation of man, the boundless love of God, and the endless striving that is born of gratitude. And it is this endless striving that by the grace of God will eventually bring me to the place where I can understand Him and the people whom He likes so much that He's chosen to call. Hey.
Seemed the letter writers told the truth. They were rebuilding a cathedral. It was nearly completed. They were doing the painting up in the dome. There were a couple of painters up there that had seen this little old Italian lady come into the church, make her stations, light her candles, tell her beads, and stay on her knees. And as some of us sometimes do, they thought they'd play a trick on her. So one morning after she had come in, gone through her usual little ritual, was on her knees in the pew, one of them said in a very deep voice, "This is Jesus Christ." There was no reaction. A couple of minutes later, in a somewhat louder voice, he repeated it. Still no reaction. And a little bit later, in a still louder voice, he repeated it. And without waiting for it to come the fourth time, the little old lady said, "Hush your mouth, I'm sticking to your mama." Kind of grows on you, doesn't it? Seven or eight years ago, when I was attending a medical meeting in Los Angeles, I had a little time to spare after a meeting in the evening. I called Cliff, who was at that time, as I recall, one of our trustees. And Cliff called our next speaker and Chet. And the four of us had a very pleasant evening, the rest of it, together. It's an evening that I haven't forgotten. A large part of it was my appreciation of being able to communicate at some depths with our next speaker. We didn't say much, but he was one of those people with whom you sense communion immediately. I've never heard his story. I'm looking forward to it, and I know you are. Chuck.
And I am an alcoholic. Hi. You know, when I got the communication from Hazel asking me to take this spot this morning, I couldn't imagine why. I think that now I know. I believe there were three reasons. Two of them you've just heard. And the third one, why she couldn't get anybody else to take it. So I appear here now as the horrible example that these good reverends have been talking about. I'm a simple guy. And I don't have any illusions much about myself. I had 43 years to run my life, and I ended up a total failure in every department of life. A failure as a husband, a father, a businessman, a man, and a drunk. At 43. Now I take credit for that. I have been able to live now for something over 7,125 days without having to take a drink of liquor or a sedating or tranquilizing pill of any kind. And I do not take credit for that. That is God as I understand Him. There are a lot of little things that have been very, very meaningful to me over the years. And I'd like to share a couple of them with you before I get lost. I reckon it was 18 and a half years ago when a chap who's in the audience here tonight, this afternoon, showed up at a meeting in Englewood where I happened to be. He was from Michigan, and he was taking tour of the country, and he wasn't stopping any place where there wasn't an AA meeting, an AA group. And he'd been down in Texas, and he picked up a little plaque down there. And on this plaque it said, "If you're not as close to God as you once were, or as you would like to be, make no mistake, you're the one that moved." And Smitty went ahead to say, "All we have to do is to come back home. And we find that God's always been there." And then one evening, early in my AA experience, a chap came up to me after the meeting was over. And he said to me, "Chuck, do you know why it's so hard to find God?" And I was tired and I didn't want to get into a long philosophical discussion. And I would have liked to abduct him. But he had me cornered. And so I said, "No. Why is it so hard for us to find God?" And the kid says, "Because he ain't lost." I've had that one with me a long time. And then one Sunday evening, about 16, 17 years ago, 18 maybe, I had talked in the little town of Highland Park. And after the meeting, three of us were standing in the middle of the room with our hands on each other's shoulders. And we were reveling in the fact that people such as us could be returned from the land of the living dead into the land of the living. And we were saying one to another, "How fortunate can a man be?" And one of these lads wasn't talking much. And finally looked at me and he says, "Chuck," he says, "I am ignorant." He says, "I ain't never read no books. There's no sense in me reading books because I don't understand." He says, "I don't know nothing about the Bible. I don't know nothing about God. But, says he, this no man can take away from me. When I practice these principles in all of my affairs, one day at a time, to the best of my ability, and when I ask for and hope for a little guidance and direction from some power which I don't understand, he says, I feel clean inside, and good things happen in my life. And when I could talk, I said, son, don't ever read no books, no time. I said, this is what the book was written about. This is the thing itself. Isn't this what you and I have always wanted? That we might feel clean inside and have good things happen in our lives. I believe this is the best definition of what AA does through us and to us that I've ever heard in my lifetime. And then this other little thing. One night, again many years ago, I'd been talking at the Broadway group in Los Angeles. And a chap came up to me after the meeting, and he was the very essence of well-being. He was dressed well, he looked good, and he had a good look. And he says to me, Chuck, when in the hell am I going to have this spiritual awakening? He says, people keep saying, keep coming back, and sometime it'll happen. But he says, it don't. And I says, well, how long have you been coming back? And he says, 8 years. And I said to him, have you had to take a drink? And he says, no. He says, I haven't had a half drink since my first meeting. And I said to him, noting his evidence of well-being, I said, well, what else has happened to you? And he started listing them. And he just kept on going. And everything good had happened to him. Except he hadn't won the Vermont primary or something. I don't know what. And by this time, I'm laughing my head off and he got mad at me. Because this was very serious. And I said to him, man, wake up. You've had it for 8 years. But you don't recognize it. Now, I said, could you get sober? On your own? Oh, he says, no. But you came here and something happened, and you haven't had a drink anymore. And he says, yes. I said, did all these good things happen to you before you got here? And he said, no. But you came here and something happened, and good things happened in your life. And he says, yes. And I said, well, all you need now is to recognize from whence it came and start thanking God and passing the ammunition and you're home free. Fish. Seems that these three little fish had had lunch and all they were doing were playing around in the water. Having a good time when a big wise fish swam by. And he said, good afternoon, children. Isn't the water fine this afternoon? And then he swam on off. And just as soon as he got out of hearing, these three little fish got together. And one of them says, the man spoke about water. He says, what's water? He says, you. Did you ever hear water? He says, no. He says, how about you? No, he says, I never heard of it. And the third one says, neither did I. So they swam all over the Pacific Ocean looking for water. In which they lived and moved and had their being. Now I wonder if that hasn't been pretty much the way with you and with me. For 30 of my 43 years of life, I was looking for your God. I looked in many philosophies and in many religions, and I didn't find it. And in January 1946, I ran out of time. Because long back there, 25 years before, I had found an elixir called alcohol. Now, when I'd found this, it was not a problem. It was an answer, proving that the problem was already here. If I hadn't needed an answer, alcohol would not have supplied it. But I needed it, and there it was. And so alcohol to me was an answer for 15 years. But after 15 years, something happened, and my answer turned into a problem. And in the next 10 years, it beat me to death. I never was one who learned easily. I recognized 10 years before I got here that I had a problem. That I wasn't drinking well. I had had a code for drinking, just as I'd had a code for everything else in life. And I wasn't drinking according to my code. And I spotted this as a personal weakness, something that I had to overcome in order to get rid of it. And I spent that next 10 years working on my problem. And the harder I worked, the worse it got, and the worse it got, the harder I worked. And I am quite sure that I would be perfectly honest in telling you that in the last 5 years, 90% of my waking time was spent on that problem. And I was still saying to myself, 5 years after everybody quit listening to me, I'll beat this thing if it's the last thing I ever do. And it came that close to being the last thing I ever did. I'm mindful also that on my next to the last drunk, after I'd made a little 6,000-mile jaunt in a blackout, I'd driven my car from Beverly Hills to Louisville, Kentucky, to North Michigan and back to the coast, and I don't remember 5% of it. And I'd gotten home and had taken to the bed to finish my drunk, This is where I always finished them. I was in bed drinking the clock around. And I never quit until I had so completely and totally depleted my body that I couldn't even roll over to look under the bed to see if I had another bottle. And this time finally came. And I had to quit. My family, for some reason, were not very cooperative in those circumstances. And so, I quit. And maybe it was 24 hours or 36 after my last drink that I was able to get up and go to the kitchen to get a glass of buttermilk. And Mrs. C. and Dickie were sitting out in the living room, and they heard me let out a beller and heard me hit the floor. And they came running out expecting to find me in an alcoholic convulsion, chewing my tongue full of holes and babbling like an idiot, as was my wont. But they didn't find me that way. I was just stretched out on the kitchen floor, peaceful as anybody ever saw. I wasn't doing nothing. I looked a great deal like a cadaver. I turned blue. And they tried to wake me up, and they couldn't, and they got a little exercise about it. And nowadays, this just tickles me pink, you know? You remember when you used to come off a drunk, and everybody in town was looking for you, 90% of whom all they wanted to tell you was that they never wanted to see you again. Why in the hell didn't they leave us alone? But no, they had to seek us out and tell us. And I'm sure my wife and my kids had been praying for me to die for at least 5 years. And they came out and find me dead. And they got all exercise. And they got the oxygen squad down there. And after some little time, they tell me, they brought me around. And there's a young doctor with them. And I was talking to him a little afterwards, and he told me to all intents and purposes that I was dead. He told me that nobody would ever be able to bring me back again under like circumstances. And he told me that if he was me, he wouldn't do that anymore. He was a get it. Well, it might have been another 48 hours when I was able to get the old dirty bathrobe on and start walking. You know, when the late president brought out this dealy about walking 50 miles a day, I sure had to laugh. I've done that before 9 o'clock in the living room on thousands of occasions. So I got the bathrobe on and I started walking up and down the living room floor, sweating, freezing, shaking, dying, and walking. And Mrs. C was standing over by the fireplace. And as I walked away from her, she says, "Chuck, don't you think you could get a little help if you'd read the book Alcoholics Anonymous?" She might as well have hit me with a ball bat. I turned around and I says, "You, my very own wife, suggesting that I read a book written by a bunch of drunks." I, who have read all the good books with a good office. And you want me to read a book written by a bunch of drunks. Why, says you, wound me deeply. How insane can you get? I'd just been dead 48 hours before. And she wounded me deeply. And I polished her off completely by saying, "And besides, I can write a better book than that myself." So you see, I could not come to Alcoholics Anonymous until I'd run out of choice. As long as I had choice, my choice was never to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. By long before this time, I had already decided that the human race was a great cosmic mistake. And I didn't even like the good people, and the drunks I hated. Because I was a drunk, and I hated me, and I hated all of you. And the very idea of me coming to a bunch of drunks for help was absolutely obnoxious to me. And I could not come until I'd run out of everything, including choice. I gave it a good fight. I threw in the family, my wife and our kids, our home, my job, my health, my sanity, my money. And that's all I had. And I lost. And I found. You know, it's a funny thing. On the next drunk that came around, it was a little different than all others, because I got drunk immediately. And I'd been a periodic in the last 10 years on purpose. Because, you see, I was going to beat this thing. And you can't fight a very good battle when you're down on your back. So I would die until I could live, and then I'd build my body into a good machine again, and then I'd psycho myself or something. And I'd analyze my last drunk. And I'd see where I made my mistakes, and I'd decide not to do it that way anymore. And then I'd get going again. Because I had to win. But I never got drunk in a hurry. I always sampled my way on back to bed. I'd start in with one, and it didn't do nothing, and then a few days later I'd take two, and they didn't do nothing. And a week later I'd go out and have a half a dozen, nothing. And a week later I'd go out and have an evening's normal drinking, nothing, not even a headache. And then I'd come up with that bright idea that this time I had done it right, I was normal. And that I could drink normally. And so I'd go about my business. I was a normal guy. Well, in a few days, I would be drinking a pint a day. But anybody can handle a pint a day. That didn't bother me. And I'd drink a pint for a little while, and then I'd step it up to 2 pints. And after a week or two, 2 pints, I'd quit eating. And you can't live on 2 pints if you don't eat. So I'd step it up to 3. And 3 pints for a little while, and then I'd get the flu. Mrs. C would call up and say, "Chuck's got the flu again." I was the fluenest man you ever saw. I had the flu for 5 years. And I was getting worse all the time, so I had to have a worse disease. So I got pleurisy, and that's a good one. You can go around holding yourself together and you don't shake, you know. People say, "What's the matter with you?" "Oh, I had a bad attack of pleurisy last night." That lasted me for 3 years. And I was getting worse all the time, so the last 2 years I had to have a worse one. And it was the old kicker. Had a heart attack last night. And you know something? After putting it 20 years, people are still coming up and asking me if I ever have any more trouble with my heart. My heart never missed a beat in his life. The trouble with mine was every time it beat, I jumped out at the back window. So I never got drunk in a hurry. I sampled my way back in every time. But this last time, I got drunk immediately. I'd had a little good fortune, and if there's anything worse for a drunk than bad fortune, it's good fortune. My boss had called me in and said to me, "You've had a lot of trouble this year." Now, he didn't mention alcohol, but he knew that I knew what he meant when he said trouble. And he says, "I think it's because of the pressure you're under, because, you see, he was non-alcoholic." And he says, "I'm going to take a little pressure off of you." So instead of shooting me, he gave me $3,000 for a Christmas present. That really put me under pressure. I'd won again. So I got drunk on the way home. And I missed everything between that night and the middle of January. And this is what I want to tell you. If my wife were talking, she's here. God love her. If she were telling this story, she would tell you that when I went to bed to drink, I put away 7 quarts of whiskey every 3 days. Now, that isn't much whiskey if you just do it for 3 days. But if you stack enough of those 3 days on top of each other, you got a lot of liquor. And that's what I'd been doing from the Friday before Christmas to the middle of January. But sometime around the middle of January, I woke up. I had nothing in my body but liquor. I hadn't eaten. I hadn't done anything but drink. But I woke up with a clear head. The clearest head I've ever had in my life. Before or since. And for the first time in my adult life, I saw me without anything between me and me. All the excuses were gone. My God Almighty, the red light. I haven't started. I've got to hurry. You ain't going any place now anyway, are you? This is the last meeting. Thank you. And I knew that morning that I'd failed in the business of living. I didn't know why, but I accepted the fact that I'd lost the battle of life. I knew why Mrs. C was divorcing me after 20 years. I knew why our kids wouldn't come home when I was around. And I knew why the boss had sent word to the house that if I ever step foot in the plant again, he's going to throw me through the window. And I totally and completely accepted the fact that morning that everything dear to me in life was gone and that I wasn't entitled to have it back. And it suddenly became very necessary for me to be sober till I died. And for one reason, and one reason only, I did not want sobriety for myself because my life was over. I knew I was going to die and I didn't care. But I needed the time I had before I kicked off to try to rub out the record. I didn't want my wife and those kids to remember me as nothing but a tongue-chewing, babbling idiot drunk. And the last thing that went through my mind before the curtain came down and I was again sick, insane, and drunk, I remembered that I'd read Jack Alexander's article in the Post in 1941. And I said to myself, If I ever live to get out of this bed, I will find AA. And then down came the curtain. And I had a lot of dying to do. But from that moment till this, I have never had to take a drink of liquor or a sedating or tranquilizing pill of any kind. Now that is God as I understand him, too. And to make it quick, I didn't have any idea I'd used all this time up. But to make it very, very quick, I have no illusions about me. I cannot run my life. I cannot run my business. I cannot run my wife or kids. I cannot run anything. Period. What can I do? I can practice these principles in all of my affairs, one day at a time, to the best of my ability. And I can share me with anybody that wants me, my experience, strength, and hope in love with anybody that wants me. And that's all I can do. And if it isn't good enough, I've got to die. That's all I can do. And that's all I do. And it must be pretty good, because I never had it so good. I never had it so good. Not only have I been sober for putting in the 20 years, but my family was put back together. I got a new body. My business life was put back together. My social life was put back together. And I have a family as big as this world, whom I love, and who love me. Now all of this would seem to be enough, wouldn't it? It's quite a lot to a guy that would have settled for the meanest old unhappy sobriety on the face of the earth. But I have something else. I have a God of my very own. That's like my shadow. He goes in and out with me. And wherever I am, he is. And every experience in my life, both the so-called good and the so-called bad, I share with him just like a little old knot-headed kid. I talk to him all the time. We talk with each other. If you'd follow me out of Laguna up the canyon, Tuesday morning coming up, you might not see anybody in the car but me. And I might be laughing, I might be crying, I might be having quite a little talk with somebody, and you wouldn't see anybody. And it would be going something like this. Look, Father, I'm reporting to duty. I'm going to move it around. I'm going to do the best I can with what I got today. And all I want out of you is a little guidance and direction and the power to carry it out. Sure, thank you. Or I might be saying, look, Dad, look what I did yesterday. Isn't this awful? Isn't this a hell of a thing for a guy like me to do? I know better. I know why I did it. I don't like it. And I'm going to do better. And with your help, I'll do a lot better. Sure, thank you. And I throw it away. And when the good thing happens, we talk that over too. I say, look, Dad, isn't this terrific? This couldn't happen to a bum like me, but it did. And I know where it came from. I sure thank you. And we throw that away. Because, you see, this is my day. I have no past. I want no future. It is my business to walk in this way. It is my business to practice these principles in all of my affairs. It is my business to share me with anybody that wants me. And it is his business to take care of me. And all I got to do is thank God and pass the ammunition. And that's all I have done. And I've done it. And I'm going to sit down. God bless you all. Thank you very much.
We come toward the end of a wonderful morning. Gee, it's afternoon. And to put the finishing touches on this for us, to make this memorable occasion just a little better, we give you Bill.
As you and I know, every AA meeting of whatever kind and purpose is really a communion. And a communion is a time when we gather together under God's grace. We close every communion with the prayer of our Lord. But before we come to that, I would like to recall to you that to us early people, and countless ones since, we have heard over the centuries the voice of Francis, one of the greatest followers of the Master. He has voiced our aspirations as none of us could. It is altogether fitting that you share with me the prayer of Francis. Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. And where there is sadness, joy. O divine Master, grant that I may not so much seek to be consoled as to console. To be understood as to understand. To be loved as to love. For it is in giving that we receive. It is in pardoning that we are pardoned. And it is in dying that we are born to eternal life. Now let us conclude. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those that trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever.
Amen.
Amen.